Please stand by, everyone. We're about to begin. Good day, and welcome to the IBM Chat with the Labs conference call. Today's call is being recorded. You should have received charts for today's call. If you did not receive those, you may go to www.ibm.com/informix/webcast. Again, www.ibm.com/informix/webcast. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Stuart Lytell, President of the International Informix Users Group. Please go ahead, sir.
Yeah, welcome everybody this morning and early in some parts of the country. And I just wanted to welcome everybody and talk a little bit about the two upcoming IDUG/IIUG conferences that we have going on and let some people know what the status of some things are there. The IIUG board has decided to venture into Europe for its first major conference this year, coming in October in Vienna, Austria. And actually, I think I'm supposed to say, because I'm new to this, we're on slide two. Coming in Vienna, Austria, this coming October at the Vienna Hilton, in cooperation or in conjunction with IDUG, we're doing a IUG track session. There's roughly over 50 sessions that will be there, and these sessions are all specific to Informix and IDS. And here's a list of some of the sessions on the slide that range from database performance to IDS internals. And I know people like John Miller will actually be there. Jonathan Leffler, another famous Informix speaker, will also be there. And there are others that are coming from around the world. So for more information and to register, you can go to iig.org/conf. And hopefully some people will make it over there, maybe from the States or people from Europe. On slide three, We're already starting to talk about the IDUG-IIUG conference for next spring, which is in San Jose, California in May. And right now we're looking for presenters. And the call for presentations is starting through the end of the month or through September 1st. And it's very easy to actually do a presentation or to submit a proposal for presentation. People think that you need to have the whole presentation due by September 1st. Actually, all we need by this time is a one- or two-sentence description, title of the presentation, and a brief outline, you know, about roughly one paragraph. That's all that's needed by September 1st. These sessions run roughly between 60 minutes or a double session for 120 minutes, and it's actually kind of prestigious to be a presenter, and it's also pretty easy. People think it's a lot harder than it is, so I encourage you to go, and if you're interested in doing it, to present. Once again, it's by September 1st. And for more information for that, you can go to iig.org/conf. And the last thing on that is anybody who is a presenter actually gets a free conference pass, which is worth about $1,895. So you don't have to pay the conference fee if you're a selected speaker. So just want to let everybody know about these two upcoming IIUG events and what's available and what's out there. And for more information, go to the IIUG website. Without further ado, I guess I am turning it over to Mr. Jerry Kazee, who is director of the Informix Lab and fresh back from a well-deserved vacation. So, Jerry, take it away.
Hey, Stuart, thanks. And hello, everybody. Welcome to the chat with the lab. And I'll just echo Stuart's comments. Hoping to see a lot of you, you know, in particular, those of you that are calling in today from Europe at the IDUG in Vienna, the 1st of October, several of us will be over there, and it should be a great event. I'll also mention that the week of October 16th through the 20th is our IBM's very first Information on Demand conference in Anaheim, California, and I think that'll be a great event as well. You'll have an opportunity to hear sessions and presentations covering a range of our products across IM, as well as you know, many sessions that are led by either partners or customers who will talk about their experience with the product. So if you can't attend one or both of those sessions, I would highly encourage you to. We're in August of this year, and I was looking over the IIUG website this morning, and there's some interesting postings out there that if you haven't looked at, I would encourage you to. I actually followed one link this morning that was actually Guy Bowerman's blog. Guy Bowerman is a senior engineer in our support organization, and one of the things that he covered in his blog was the success of the Informix business the first half of the year. Of course, we don't talk about the numbers publicly, but we've had a great first half of the year. Our business is growing, and not only are we growing with our existing customers, but we're winning new customers as well with IDS version 10. One example of a customer whose name, unfortunately, I can't mention, but it's a large customer in Europe who was actually a former Informix customer, Informix partner actually, who left Informix and went to Oracle in the late 1990s, and with the help of one of our very large business partners in Europe, we were able to demonstrate the TCO and administration savings opportunities with version 10, and actually was able to persuade that customer to migrate their applications back to IDS using version 10. And moving forward, they'll be migrating, displacing Oracle and migrating their customer base to Informix. So, you know, we're having good success, again, with not only with you know, growing our business with our existing customers, of which I would thank all of you for continuing to use our software, but also we're growing by bringing in new customers and by displacing the competition as well. So we fully intend to continue that momentum in the second half of the year. So today's chat with the lab is we're very fortunate to have John Miller, who has been a very busy speaker over the course of this year. John was recognized as the IIUG Director of the Year, and I should know that title, right? But he was recognized for his exceptional service and dedication to the Informix community at the IDUG event in May in Tampa, where I think he gave about 36 sessions on Informix over the course of that week. And he's also done a number of Chat with the Labs as well. And so today, John will be doing a session on OnStat, and I'm sure that you'll find the material that he covers a useful material that you can immediately apply to your environment and get immediate benefit from it. So with that, John, I'll turn the session over to you.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the talk. I'll dive right into it because we have a lot of information to cover. We're going to take some question and answers at the end, so save your questions up, write them down. Just to kind of overview what I'm going to go over, I'm actually on slide number 4. We are going to talk about some recent changes to OnStat, nice subtle things that have happened that really I feel make it very usable. We're also going to look, our first block is really on using OnStat to look at the I/O of the system through a variety of ways, looking at, you know, from the disk view, and then looking at some network I/O. Start into the memory area, looking at both cache and memory usage. And then something that I feel is not as well understood is how to view actions by user or by table. And so we'll drive into that, look at the variety of actions that occur so you can understand where, how, and why the activity is coming in. So that's what we're going to be looking at today. And so we will move on to slide number 5. OnStat is a very dynamic tool for us. It's constantly being enhanced. Constantly, things are being added to by the developers. It's a very useful tool for support. I think it's very useful for the customers. And in some of the recent changes, probably the nicest I like was the fact that some of the options can be displayed or used when the server's offline. This is new. OnStat-M used to show you the tail of the server log, so you could basically see what the server was doing. That only operated when the server's down. A lot of times, if there was an issue with the server or the server wasn't operating, you also want to look at that log. So OnStat-M now works both in online mode and offline. Really find that useful. I ran into it by accident when I was working with it, and I ran the command and assumed that the server was up and operational, and it wasn't, because it works both online and offline. And similarly, the configuration file. You can display the configuration file now with the server both online and offline. And I just find those to be very useful and very practical for DBAs. On to slide 6. New options. Some we're going to go through, and some I'm just going to actually mention. OnStat-G, E, and V. We're going to look at this in detail. And that just really is there to display the environment. There's an OnStat-G STM, which shows you the statements running on the system and prepared. And we'll go into that in detail, so I won't mention a lot. A few others that we're not going to go into in a lot of detail is OnStat-G RWM, and that's for the read-write mutexes that exist on the system. So you can list the different mutexes and who's holding what, what's going on. Another one that's been enhanced is the OnStat-C to show you what the B-tree scanner is doing. And lastly, OnStat-GCAC will display various caches, several SQL caches, several access method caches, but just a lot of information about the different caches that you might or might not be aware of. There's I think somewhere on the order of about 10 different caches it'll display information about. So if we move to slide 7, we actually look at OnStat-G, E, and V. If you just run the command as it's stated, you will get the server's startup environment. And there's a little snapshot of that on the left. I couldn't display the entire environment, but just wanted to give you a list. You know, the DB delimiter set there to a pipe, DB path to a dot, DB temp to slash temp. And these are values that if the session doesn't set, will be inherited from the server. The user can override these, but these pick up as the defaults. And then OnStat G, E, and V, followed by a session ID, lets you look in to the user's Informix environment and show you what environment variables the user has set and what they are set to. And that showed there on the right. We show the OnStat G, E, and V session 147. We tell you what session you're printing out and then give you the list of Informix environment variables. So that's one thing I want to point out. This is not the environment of the entire session and every environment variable set by that session. It's just the Informix environment variables. So, and that really is helpful because every once in a while you get those users who, you know, set an environment variable just trying a few things out, and all of a sudden they call in and say, you know, it's not working like I expected. You look at their environment, you see, oh, you have PDQ priority set. You know, it's not good in, for this application. Or they've changed resource allocation. So, on to slide 8. OnStat G STM. This is available in a variety, a few of our different servers. It is not just in version 10, but it is one of the newer ones. You know, it shows you all current SQL statements. It shows you whether they are active, they're the active statement for that session, or whether it's a statement that has been prepared but is currently not in use. The other thing highlighted in the red box is actually the amount of SQL memory this statement is currently utilizing. If we look at the first statement, we see that the heap size is 11,936. And that means that there are approximately 11K in memory used by that statement. The unit is in bytes. The other thing that's a little harder to see is right on the right side of the red line, I overlaid it a little bit, there is an asterisk in front of the SQL statement. The asterisk highlights the currently active statement that has open cursors. So you can see that. The second block, session 14, you see that there are a few different statements there. So it's just an attempt to show you that you can get all the currently prepared statements for a user. And if you run this on a large system, you will see hundreds of SQL statements, you know, coming out. So it is a fairly lengthy report on a large system, so just beware of that. It's also a nice way at a cursory glance to see what SQL statements are being run on that state on that system. It's a nice overview for that type of activity. On to the next slide, which is slide 9. We are going to look at I.O., and there's a variety of ways to look at I.O., and we don't have a lot of time, so I picked one that is a little more less common. I know there's a lot on OnStat-G, and IOF shows you by file, but I wanted to pick OnStat-G IOV and an attempt to show you how to tune the I.O. on the system. Everyone always asks the question, well, how many AIOVPs should I have? And really, the best way is to watch the inverted pyramid. The AIOVPs, the class, the following less column shows you the different class names. And so we are looking at the AIOVPs. The operations get assigned from the first VP on down. If the first one's busy, it's assigned to the second, and so on and so on. And so the first one is generally always going to be the busiest. The second, a little less busy, and down. If you see that on your AIOVPs that they don't make an inverted pyramid, the operations don't stagger by orders of magnitude, there is a very good chance that you do not have enough AIOVPs. And so you should allocate more. That can be done online with the OnStat-P AIO command. So I would allocate more. If we go on to the next slide, again, OnStat-G IOV, you see that we point to a column that has errors at the top. If you do see errors, it's really an indication that the kernel AIO subsystem is not performing well, and that the general issue is a lack of resources set up between the operating system and the Informix Dynamics server. So if you do see errors, definitely look for that. The last slide for the OnStat-G IOV, slide 11, we point to a column that has a heading of S. Not too descriptive, but it stands for state. So the S tells you the state of the associated AIOVP or other VP. The two most common states you see are an S, indicating that that VP is sleeping inside a system call or doing an I/O operation. It could be doing a write, could be doing a read, but it is at that time actually executing an operating system call. If that column is an I, that VP is idle. It is doing no work. It is sitting there sleeping on a semaphore. So it is asleep. It is idle. It's not being used at the current time. Again, another great indication is if you have all the states of your AIO VPs at an S, you have allocated too few AIO VPs, and you need to increase the number on your system. Some of the best times to monitor this are when you are running update statistics, archives, when you're doing your backups. That is a great time. I've heard a lot of people say, well, when I start my backup up, my whole system slows down. Well, when you go look at their AIO VPs, you see that they are severely underpowered because the archive puts a large drain on the system for I/O. And when you actually increase those, the impact to the users, to the system of the backup, was reduced a significant amount. So please look at the state and that inverted pyramid. The inverted pyramid on the total operations really it can lead you to how the system looks over a fairly lengthy time, so you get a good running average. So that's really the OnStatG IOV. To look more at a traditional method, we're going to look at OnStatG IOF. This really associates a file name and gives you the total number of operations run against that file, both the reads and the writes, you know, the disk reads, how many times have we read from the disk writes, how many times have we written to the disk. So you can tell where the I/O is by the file. And lastly, the average I/Os per second. We try and take an average over the recent past and give you that so you can kind of see how that file is performing. You know, if one file's up at 100 I/Os a second and all the other ones are a lot lower, it does give you a spot where you might want to look at moving data around. With all the logical volume managers now, that sometimes helps, but on sometimes it's managed beneath you. Okay, the next slide, slide 13. Looking at monitoring resources by client type. We're looking at some of the network OnStats now, not as common, but sometimes very, very powerful. The first basically breaks down the operation by client type. I've tried to list some of the more common client types. SQL exec is probably the most common. Those are all your standard users that would connect via an application, JDBC, ODBC, embedded SQLC. They will connect and show up as SQL exec users. Server Informix, some of the remote distributed SQL, OnCheck, basically the OnCheck utility, we see other utilities. You see OnTape does produce a fair amount of I/O back and forth to the network. The information you receive, we have the accepted. How many connections have we accepted for that client type? So, for the SQL exec, we have seen that applications have connected to the server 4,744 times. The total number of network reads and writes is listed on the far right. They have their own column, so you can kind of see what type of network activity is being placed on the system. Now, let's move to the next slide, where we actually get to drill down by user. This is slide 14. We get to see from the network we have the connection type on the far left there. You know, we're coming in via sockets. We have the thread name, again, mainly SQL exec application threads. And then the session ID column. The session ID is what links it to users, and often a lot of our onset commands are driven by session ID. What we have highlighted in the light blue box are the reads and writes. So you can see how much activity each user or the different applications are putting on the system. You know, here we have a session that has 1,586 writes and a session that has 1,586 reads, 1,585 writes. It lets you see the network activity by user. And these are reads and writes out to the network layer, whether that's via shared memory, sockets, TLI, streams, pipes, any of the variety of methods supported. Okay, if we move to the next slide, we see one of the probably more useful commands for giving a quick summary of how the memory looks at a very quick instance. We have the different shared memory segments allocated by the Informix server. These are how we manage the operating system memory. We ask for blocks of memory and put them into logical segments. We group them by class, and the different classes you generally see are R for resident segment, V for virtual segment, M for message segment, and X for an extended shared memory segment used by the extensibility, if so desired. The V is usually the segment you see grow and shrink the most. The R segment is very static in nature. Once it comes up, it'll sit there. And the two columns I really want you to take a look at are the ones on the far right, the blocks used and the blocks free. This gives you the ability to look at how much is used and free in a very quick glance. For the recent servers, versions 9 and 10, the blocks of units are in 4 kilobyte units. If you're looking at version 7, you're looking at 8 kilobyte units. So, you know, we can see very quickly how many blocks are free. We get a totals down at the bottom. We know that those totals are in 4K blocks, and we can find out right away what our free and used memory looks like. On to slide 16. We're now going to change directions and start looking at some of the various caches and looking at actions by user. So we're done with the onstat and the network I/O and a quick look at some of the memory, and we're on to different cachings and users. So next slide. Slide 17, there's a lot of different caches to monitor. So the most common and probably the most important is the buffer cache. Databases are there to provide quick access to data. The buffer cache buffers your data, and so we will look at the buffer cache very quickly. Some of the other caches that you might or might not be aware of is the data dictionary. This is basically the information in the system catalogs. That information, which describes your tables, we want to keep cached for your tables in a format that we can directly access. And that's stored in the data dictionary. Data distributions. This is your update statistics, medium and high information. For your common tables, we want to keep that information in memory so we can quickly optimize your queries without having to go to disk. A lot of people use stored procedures. There's a cache to keep the stored procedures in memory. You look at how that is performing. And lastly, there's several extensibility caches, not just one, but many. And so you can look at a lot of those. The first is actually, we will start off on page 18. And there's the, well, this is probably one of the more common places people look. It's onstat-p. It gives you a great summary of the server. But if we want to look at the buffer cache, we really want to concentrate more on the first line. The first two great indicators are the read buffer cache and write buffer cache, highlighted in red. You know, in the 90s is a great percentage. You know, we really need to look at the different applications for what's going to be best for you. Some data warehouses might have lower or higher buffer caches. Higher OLTP activity will have higher caches than typically warehouses. Again, that can change, though, different things for different environments. But generally in the 90%, high 90s for read caches. Sometimes the lower 90s are okay for write caches. But that tells you, you know, how it can do. And, of course, every time you increase your buffers, you can look at the cache percentage and monitor that. Increasing caches, increasing your buffers doesn't always help the write cache. Really, we often look at the checkpoint tuning and your LRUs and your max dirty and min dirty to really tune the write cache. And those are things you need to look at. Sometimes increasing your buffers can actually decrease your write cache. So just be aware of those issues. The next slide, slide 19, shows you how to break down the buffer pools by table. Not always used. By a lot of people. It's fairly new, but it breaks down the buffers. We have the first column is part num, and that's the link to the table index fragment found in sys-tables or sys-fragments. So you can find the name of the object out of sys-tables or sys-fragments. It is a, and then so with that table or fragment identification, you can see how many pages are currently in the buffer pool for this table or fragment. How many of those pages are indexed? How many of those pages are data? And then we have a category of other. Other pages are, one would be a bitmap page, which keeps track of the state of the different pages in the table. Usually there's not too many of them, but they're generally in the buffer cache because they get accessed frequently. So that breaks down the buffer cache by table. If we go on to the next slide, really want to point out at the bottom of that is a very, very useful tool. It breaks down overall percentages of your buffer cache. Here we see that the buffer cache is made up of 72.86% data pages and 25.58% index pages and 1.5% of other pages. This is a really good indicator. You know, if you're in an OLTP environment, you expect a fairly decent breakdown between index and data pages. If you were in an OLTP environment and saw that your 99% data pages, there's definitely some sequential scanning going on that is destroying your buffer cache. You know, on the other hand, if you saw that you were 90% index pages in the buffer pool, you know, then there might be other issues that need to be looked at, such as, you know, the data is just not being accessed through the indexes properly and the correct data is not being kept in the buffer cache. So, you know, if you're on a data warehouse, the data cache rate or the data percentage is probably a lot higher, a lot more access through data pages directly. Okay, on to the next slide, slide 21. This is a picture of an OnStatG DIC. The OnStatG DIC shows us what is in the data dictionary. It will show you each table that is currently in the data dictionary cache. In there, we see, in the current picture, we see database D1 at Olympia, J. Miller, table name T2. We see that there are 31 lists, and each list can be a maximum size of 10. So we have 310 entries for the data dictionary. We are currently using only two. This is listed at the bottom line, totaled up for you. In this picture, it's easy to see that there's only two. But in, you know, if you had 157 or 200 in use, it's a little harder to find out. But this gives you a great idea. You know, it's sized at 310, 31 by 10, and currently in use is two. You know, if you have a lot of tables and you feel your application does access those at the same time, and that number is, you know, upwards in 200 or 300, in this case, our data dictionary might not be tuned as well as we think. So we could look at tuning the data dictionary. A very similar output is produced on the next slide, which is slide 22. OnStatG DSC shows us about the data distributions, the update statistics, medium and high information. It's a little different in its display. The number of lists we have is 31. Our current entries, again, is 2. The size is 50. So we try and keep 50 active entries in this database or in this cache. And we see currently we have the stores database, the customer table, and the last name column. And stores database, customer table, company column. So this information is kept by column. All the columns you run update statistics on, medium and high, can come through this cache. The ones that will be commonly accessed are going to be join columns or columns you filter on. Anytime we filter on a column or join on a column, we will need to read entries out of this cache. And this helps the optimizer. If this cache is filled up, you know, the optimizer can access those update statistics information quickly without having to request that data from disk. So the next slide, slide 23, is the stored procedure cache. It's very similar to the previous one. Want to make sure you are aware of it. The sizing and usage information is identical again, but looking at the entries, the three that are in there, we have a sysdist entry, a stored procedure called bitval, and a stored procedure ldtodate. So those are the procedures that are currently in there. If you use a lot of stored procedures, I would suggest that you monitor this cache, make sure it's sized correctly. Not having it sized correctly, you know, if you're using hundreds or thousands of stored procedures, you really want to make sure that this cache is tuned. Every time you execute a stored procedure, you don't want to have to bring it in from disk. You want it right there to be in the cache. The next slide, slide 24, lists some of the other extensible caches. We're not going to go through them all. The output looks similar to OnStats that we've previously seen, but to list them, you have user-defined routines, the routine cache, the type of variables you're dealing with, a cache, converting one data type to another is a cache, the operator class, access methods, is it an index, is it an R tree, secondary access methods, and user-defined aggregates. So some of the more caches that are used in the system. Okay, that's really all we're going on with caches, and we're going to spend the last few minutes here looking at actions and how to tell what's going on in your system, by whom, or by what table. So in slide 25, we are going to look at an OnStat that can look fairly intimidating at first, but we're going to break it down into pieces. OnStat G PPS stands for Partition Profile Information. You can run it without any arguments, and it displays every table or partition or fragment on your system. Or you can give it a part num if you're interested in a specific table, and it will list just that table's information. The first major breakdown we're going to look at is, in blue, we have the part number. That's the link to the table, fragment, index, and again, that information, the part num, can be linked to an exact table or index name through sys-tables or sys-fragments. The second section in red is the locks. This is information about locks, and we'll drive down into each one of these major blocks. The third section, highlighted in kind of a goldy yellow, maybe an orange, is the SQL-like actions. What's gone on? Who's done it? And the last section in a pink is the buffer section, how this table has accessed the buffer pool. And so we are going to drive into the first section on slide 26 and look at the part num. We've talked about that already. Really going to step into the first column highlighted there, lock request. Every time a table has been requested the lock, a page, a row, a table, this is incremented. So we see that we have different tables. The first one has had 11 requests to lock an action or object, 205 locks, 15, 5, and the last one has not, table or index has not locked anything. So these are the locks that have occurred on that table. Generally, if you're in row or page level locking, you can make a one-to-one correspondence between those. There are a few other table locks that can occur, but those are usually less frequent. And this is one I put in yellow because you want to pay attention to it a little bit. If you're getting a lot of lock requests on a table, you're accessing it a lot, and you can look at tuning different things. The next one, LKWTS, is lock weights. Really wanted to highlight this. Having lots of these means your users are waiting to access the object you want. If you set lock mode to wait 10 seconds and you are waiting, this will be incremented. And this will tie you back to a table. So a lot of times it's a way of finding out which SQL is waiting on the locks, what table's really the one that's being the bottleneck for your applications. We don't like users to wait. The next DLKS is actually deadlocks. How many times you've encountered a deadlock? and had to be broken out because of a deadlock. T-outs I don't have listed, but that's timeouts. Again, one you might want to pay attention to. When you set lock mode to wait, you set it to 10 seconds, and you do not acquire the lock with after waiting for 10 seconds, you will have had a timeout. You would have timed out the lock and still not acquired it. Very, very useful information when trying to tune those applications, especially when you don't have a lot of knowledge about what those applications are doing. The next column, next slide, sorry, is on page 27. Here we're going to drill down into the SQL actions for that table. They're broken down into kind of basic operations. ISRD is ISAM reads. And this is the number of times a row has been read from that table. So if we want to know which table has had the most rows read from it, we can look down and look under the ISRD column and see that we've had 1,854 rows read from the bottom table. ISWRT is ISAM writes. You can equate this to inserts, the number of rows inserting. And a fun thing to do is if you know you're loading a big table up and you have a million rows to insert, you can watch this column just go up, and when it's incremented by a million, you'll know that table's been loaded. So you can kind of see at what stage you are in the load. ISRWT is ISAM rewrites. You can equate this to an update. How many times have you updated this table? ISDEL is the ISAM deletes, the number of times you have deleted a row from this table. All of these actions are in rows, so they're not in statements. They're not in how many SQL statements, but how many rows have actually acted. And we'll flip to the next slide, which is slide 28, and we'll look at the far right. Again, the far right was the buffer information. BFRD is the number of times pages have been read from this table. So this is the number of times we have gone to this table and read a page from the buffer pool. BFWRT is the number of times we have written pages into the buffer pool. Those are modified pages written back into the buffer pool. And the last one is sequential scans, SEQSC, the number of times you have sequentially scanned this table. I'll oftentimes look at the sequential scan count on tables and see, does that correspond to what I think it should be. You know, a good way of finding, you know, tables that are poorly indexed, look at that sequential scan count. So that gives you a really good idea, a starting place to find those poorly indexed tables. Okay, on to slide 29. We're going to wrap up with our last OnStat we're going to look at, which is OnStat GTPF. This stands for Thread Profile. Again, if you don't give any options to the TPF, it displays all threads. If you give it a specific thread ID, it will display just that thread ID. This information is, each thread is tied to a session. A session has at least one thread, but can have multiple threads if you're doing parallel actions. And a create index can create multiple threads. A select that does a parallel sort would have multiple threads. So there's lots of different actions that will use several threads per session. Again, the first column in blue is the user threads. The second column is our locks. The two sections highlighted in red is information about our logging. The purple section is our SQL-like actions. The yellow section is information about transactions. The black section, there's two of them, have information about our buffering. And again, these are specified in users. If we go on to slide 30, we see that the thread ID. We've talked a little bit about that, that each thread ID is tied to a specific session, and there could be a many-to-one relationship, session IDs. The thread ID is just there so you can tie it back to a specific user. If we go to slide 31, we'll look at the actions from the logging perspective. The LGRS is the number of log records this user has created and written into your logical logs. If they've inserted 5,000 rows, you will see at least 5,000 log records written in there. Probably a few more because they've updated maybe a few other actions along the way. The LSUS is the log space used. This is how many bytes of data this user has written into the logical log space. LSMX is the amount of log space taken by their largest transaction. So if we look at the top line, line 42, we have seen this user has put in 408 log records. They've used 856 bytes, and their largest transaction was 120 bytes. So just things to keep you aware of. Very good in tracking down long transactions or transactions that are getting close to your high water marks. If we go on to slide 32, you can see the ISCT is the number of commits this user has done, this thread or which basically ties back to the user. The ISRB is the number of rollbacks. Worth a very quick look, because if your user is doing a high number of rollbacks for commits, there might be some inefficiencies done in that user's application. LX is the number of long transactions. So if this user has five LXs, they've had five long transactions, and those definitely waste a lot of resources on the system. Slide 33, looking very similar to our partition profile, we have a thread profile to find out how many rows read, how many rows inserted, how many rows updated, and how many rows deleted by thread. So not only can you get the number of rows processed by table, you can correspond those to the number of rows processed by user or thread. Slide 34, the number of locks. And again, very important when looking at users. You know, number of lock requests, want to watch on lock waits and deadlocks. We want to keep track of which users are always having to wait when they need to acquire a lock. And so that's LKWTS is the lock waits. The LDLKS is the deadlocks, and the TO is the lock timeouts. The same meaning is in the PPF. We have the thread profile here. And our last slide, actions by user. Just to try and interpolate and use some of this information, a good ratio I always like to look at is the total number of SQL actions per row divided by the buffer reads and buffer writes. This gives you an idea of how much each user is doing. So how many pages per row is this user touching? The higher the ratio, Either it means you're doing a lot of sequential scanning and maybe you're more of a data warehouse. Data warehouses don't always sequential scan, but they tend to do more than OLTP. For OLTP, you know, that you want that ratio to be lower. You want to go right to an index page, right to a row, without having to do a lot of work to get there. If you have a really high ratio or the ratio seems to be going up over time, we want to be looking at the indexing or optimizer issues. So just a quick rule of thumb, something you might not have thought of there. I'm not saying it's the golden rule, but it gives you a good rule of thumb on how much work. And at this time, you know, start thinking of your questions, but I'm going to turn it over and ask the operator to take a survey here while you're thinking of those questions. Millicent, can you?
Thank you. At this time, we'll conduct a brief electronic survey. After I finish reading all of the entire question and all of the possible responses, please answer by firmly pressing the star key followed by the number on your touch-tone phone that corresponds to your choice. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signals to reach our equipment. Again, please press the star key followed by the number on your touch-tone telephone that corresponds to your choice. And remember to disengage your mute function to allow your signals to reach our equipment. There will be a brief pause between each question to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. And we'll take our first question. One moment. Question one. The level of technical detail in this presentation was star 1, right, star 2, not technical enough, or star 3, too technical. Again, the question, the level of technical detail in this presentation was star 1, about right, star 2, not technical enough, or star 3, too technical. One moment. Again, the level of technical detail in this presentation was star 1, about right, star 2, not technical enough, or star 3, too technical. We'll give everyone an opportunity to signal. And we'll move on to our second question. Question 2, the speaker for this presentation was star 1, excellent, star 2, good, or star 3, fair, or star 4, poor? Again, question 2. The speaker for today's teleconference was star 1, excellent, star 2, good, star 3, fair, or star 4, poor? We'll give everyone an opportunity to signal. And we'll move on to our third question. Star 3, overall teleconference rating. Star 1, excellent. Star 2, good. Star 3, fair. Or star 4, poor. Again, question 3. Overall teleconference rating. Star 1, excellent. Star 2, good. Star 3, fair. Star 4, poor. And we'll pause for a moment. And our final question today, would you like someone from IBM to contact you regarding the IDS version 10? Star 1 for yes, star 2 for no. Again, our final question, would you like someone from IBM to contact you regarding IDS version 10? star 1 for yes, star 2 for no. That would conclude our electronic survey. At this time, if anyone would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone phone. Again, star 1 at this time for any questions. And we'll pause momentarily. Our first question will come from Charles Connors with DB Stores. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, you alluded to that lock requests can be tuned. I'm interested in how could you, because I thought that was just a natural indication of activity on the table and didn't think that was tunable. And is that a problem?
You know, Charles, it is not a problem in itself. It does indicate activity on a table. You're right, there's not a lot of options for tuning it, but there is one or two. One to look at would be if you change your default locking mode to row for every single table in your system. So when you by default you just create a table with row-level locking, and then you have read-only tables, which you access, you know, frequently or something like that. You could look at changing those to page-level locking. So, again, just a way of aggregating more of those locks. If this is, you know, like a state table, you're always looking up in, and it's, you know, not really big, so utilizing an index might not be most efficient because you keep your data in two or three pages.
Right.
You could look at page-level locking.
Okay.
You're right, you don't have a lot of options because you do, you have to lock those rows. But you might be able to utilize page-level locking. Also, if you have a lot of lock weights and you are at page-level locking, you might want to look to row. So, and some of those things just get overlooked, and a little change can sometimes make a big difference.
Great.
So was that kind of getting at what you were driving
exactly
to there?
Yeah. I did have one more question, but I have to.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The next question is relating to the onset-GIOQ output. Now, we're getting a high number of max links for the GFDs for my data DB spaces, but a very low max link number in the AIO max link. Now, I understand that the AIO max link indicates if there's a bottle IO bottleneck, and is that true? And if that's true, how important is the high max link? I mean, they're triple digits in my temp DB spaces and my data DB spaces.
Okay. OnStat GIOQ is a little more tricky to interpret. One is you really can't look at that max length once you've gone through a checkpoint. Because the first thing a checkpoint is going to do is take all those modified buffers and toss them right on there, all at one instance. So if you have 1,000 modified buffers, you know, the page cleaners are going to go through, collect all those, and submit them to the IO system instantaneously. So, you know, all of a sudden you go from nothing to 500 being put on there, and they get spread across. So that max length is going to get high during the checkpoint. I mean, you just can't avoid it.
That's a high watermark, right?
That is a high watermark, yep.
So if I have a temp DB space and it says max Q length 200, does that mean the database server is waiting to process these I/O?
Database server is waiting to process those I/O. You know, yes, it could be. It means that there was 200 operations submitted at most 200 operations queued up. And now it has to process those 200.
But not necessarily waiting. Just, I don't know what that queue means. A queue tells me it's in a queue and waiting to be processed.
Think of it as a disk drive a little bit. If you submit 10 operations to the disk drive, it's going to process them one at a time.
Right.
And so you submitted 10 there. The checkpoints is what really interferes. You're almost better to do an onstat-z after a checkpoint and then let it run and look at it before your next checkpoint and look at the queue length, the max queue length, just during normal running.
So you said don't use that to determine whether or not there is an I.O. bottleneck or...
I would go to the IOV.
Onstat-D?
The one we talked about, onstat-G, IOV.
Oh, V.
V, the ones in the slide. And I would look at the total operations.
Right.
And if they don't look like an inverted pyramid,
okay.
You know, the first one has lots, and you go down to the bottom one, and it's used a lot less.
Uh-huh.
If you see that they're all the same order of magnitude, you definitely have an I.O. bottleneck.
If they're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that's what you wanted. That means there's the I.O. is spread across the DB spaces, but no, huh?
No, this is the IOV. This is not, doesn't have anything about spreading across the DB spaces.
Oh.
This is just by virtual processor.
Okay.
And, again, look at the state, see if they're all sleeping at the same time. Then you don't have enough resources, and that truly does indicate an I.O. bottleneck.
Which column am I looking at, focusing on the I.O.V.?
The I.O.V., the third column that starts with an S, and the fifth column that starts with total operations.
Okay. Tell me again what to look for.
You know what? It's right in the slides.
Okay.
So I'd really show you just to look at, I think, you know, it's right on about slide 10 and 12, the two slides talking about watching the inverted pyramid.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Zev Darwin. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hi, Zev. How are you doing today?
Yes, fine. First of all, thank you, John, for a great presentation.
You're most welcome.
All right, two questions. One about the ISAM and the buffer. How would you define the difference is why, like, ISAM could be a zero in the last slide, and by buffers it could be buff reads, buff writes could be could have numbers.
There's a few. One is I made up a lot of these numbers when I had to type them in, so they're not actually. So don't look at my slides as, you know, actuals. I did take real ones, and then in the attempt to line them up, I kind of wrote over them, but some of the things that bypass buffer reads, you know, when we do on-checks, on-check will go ahead and process things not by rows, so it'll read tables without actually going through the row interface, so you can get buffer reads and buffer writes that way, more so buffer reads, light scans, light appends, don't really go through the row interface, so there's ways to get actions that way. Indexes, operations on indexes will go through the buffer pools without processing rows. So, you know, one thing with the part num you need to find out is if it's a table or an index.
So, like, on my own, what would be a good example to gain a clearer understanding of how many buffer reads for a regular insert or how many buffer writes for a regular delete or an update?
You know, in just isolation, you're trying to do like a monatomic analysis, or are you just trying to get averages?
Yeah, just trying to understand it.
You know, if you want to do it, you can do it off on a side, on a system that, you know, create your own table, the schema and insert one row and monitor it that way. You know, the buffer reads and buffer writes are not broken down by individual SQL actions. you know, the buffer reads or the number of buffer reads across the reads, the writes, and the deletes and updates. So you have to be, if you want to find out for a specific operation, you'll have to isolate that operation.
Okay. One more question.
Mm-hmm.
In the onstat-giov, we have for the KIO, so
mm-hmm.
I believe those are controlled by the numcpu vps onconfig parameter. How would I know over there if basically I don't have now an inverted pyramid, I just have a lot, I base the numcpu on the amount of actual CPUs in the system. How would I know how to tune that?
And maybe the good point, I probably didn't make this clear enough. The inverted pyramid is just for the AIO VPs. So when you're tuning your system, if you have AIO VPs, we just want to look at that inverted pyramid for your AIO VPs. When you use kernel AIO, you will see, which I don't have represented on the slide, a KIO entry in there, which I believe you're talking about.
Right.
You know, those are going to be spread across your one per CPU VP, and that's really all you want. And we keep the operations local. So whatever thread is running on CPU VP1, he submits them right to that thread, right to the kernel AIO on that VP. We don't want them sending them to a VP across the, you know, across the hall or something. And so they are processed there. So to find out if your kernel AIO is having any problems, you really want to look at the online log and at the error column at the end. So it's more on the, probably about bottom of slide, I don't have the slide numbers with me, but it was about slide 10. It was the last slide in watching the inverted pyramid. We pointed the error column. If you see that column being incremented, that means the interface between Informix and the operating system's kernel AIO is not tuned well. And for each operating system, sometimes we have information in the release notes on how to tune that, and sometimes you're just going to have to, you know, do a little research yourself on how to tune that interface. You know, on HP, there's some environment variables you can set to increase those resources. Similar on AIX, on Solaris, it's a little more dynamic inside the kernel itself. I think this, on Linux, there's actually an environment variable also.
And what would appear on the message log if there is any type of errors?
It's like KAIO out of resource message. If you see it, it's pretty clear. It's KIO or KAIO resource error or something like that. I don't have the exact term in front of me.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much, John, again, for a great presentation.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Sierra Taylor. Your line is open.
Hi there. I was wondering about onstat-gstm. A lot of times I see an open bracket and SPL statement instead of an actual select star from whatever. And I was wondering how to drill down into what that actual SPL statement is.
You know, that's a little more difficult
mm-hmm.
because SPLs are pre-optimized and pre-compiled.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really don't in order to provide that information, you really need to decompile the procedure to find out which stored procedure statement were out at the exact instant. There is a little more information under onstat-g, SES, or SQL. So if you have a session and it's currently executing an SPL,
mm-hmm.
The onstat-g, SES, or SQL will provide you a little bit more information. You know, it gives you the procedure name, the procedure stack. So you can see procedure 1 is calling procedure 2 is calling procedure 3.
Okay.
You do need to be user informix when running that.
Mm-hmm.
Else that information will not print out. So if you're some other user and you execute it, that information will be left off because they feel that's for DBIs only, for
okay.
DBAs only. I feel like James Bond there.
One other question I had from onstat-capital P. If my other column at the bottom of the output is significantly higher than my other ones, I've never looked at that before, is that something, how would I tune that, or what's wrong with it?
Well, really, it would take a little bit of investigation. One is if you just started up your server, there is no data. You know, there is, or there's very few data pages. There's very few index pages when you just start up. So they're all in the other column. So that's one thing. Onstat-capital B is very verbose, but it shows you the state of every page in the buffer pool, and you can actually find out what are those other pages.
Okay, thanks very much.
Don't know if they're blobs or, you know, what other types of things.
Okay, great, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob Salomon, your line is open.
Hi, John.
Hi, Jacob, how you doing?
Okay. I haven't seen you in a long time.
Yes.
I'm going to start with my second question because it's more of a comment. I'm very tempted to rewrite all of these things as if I could. For example, onstat minus capital P, to see that to change his part nums into actual table names, to go back into SysMaster and see what table or index this is, because it's very frustrating just to see a jumble of numbers. Once you showed us that's minor. I can always do that with my own Perl script. Once you've shown us the onstat minus GIOV, of course I had to try it out. And I noticed the AOVP, the total ops is not much of what I would call a pyramid, but the disk reads are definitely in that form. We've got two, the AO numbers 0 and 1 are fairly close, within 50,000 of each other or so. And after that, it's a sharp drop-off, and I'm watching the 16 AOVPs just head gradually down. The lowest one is at 963 since started. Okay, so as far as reads are concerned, AIOs are nicely configured. I go to disk writes. Now, the application that's running right now is loading time series, so it's definitely doing a lot of writes. It's always doing massive loads. And nearly all the rows that I'm looking at are the same. Okay, so I will take that as an indication that I need to add AOVPs to this mix.
Yeah, Jacob, the one other place I would look would be the third column that starts with a single letter S. And look at the I or S state.
Okay, most of them are idle. The first two are sleeping.
They're in a system call.
Oh, they're a system call.
Or idle. So if you actually see them all at an S state, that would be the indication to add more. If you do see some that are always idle, then you're okay. I would really have you look during a checkpoint, Jacob. I'm guessing what's happening is during checkpoint processing, all those dirty buffers are being flushed, and all the AOVPs get kicked off at once. You might not have enough for your checkpoint.
Okay, that's possible, although I have to go back to check what my LRU max and min dirties are for these. I think they're 5 and 10. I think my max and min dirties are 10 and 5.
Yeah. The
buffer pools.
If you error, you want to error on having too many.
Mm-hmm.
Having an extra one of these is very, very low resource requirement. Having too few will cause you severe performance problems.
I also noticed that the top two IOs per second are the AO number 0 and 1, the ones that I found sleeping. Let me run it again so maybe the numbers will change. Yeah, the numbers IOs per second, AO 0, it's 181 per second, and the other one, the next one is 159, and the others are 14 and lower.
Yeah, so see, they're getting used quite a bit, and the other ones are okay.
Okay.
I think in your day-to-day operations, you're okay, but I look at, like, backup and restores and checkpoints and just make sure you're okay during those operations.
Okay. I'd like to ask a question that's a little bit out of the topic of what we were talking about, if it's all right with you. I wanted to ask a bit about fuzzy checkpoints. Okay, is that okay with you?
If it's a quick one, I'd be happy to. Otherwise, I think I ought to...
Okay, because you just stated a topic. Okay. Okay, it's not going to be a quick question. I'll have to put it off the
wait,
time or the thread. Yeah.
If there's no one else, I'll be happy to take it.
Okay.
Thank you, Jacob.
Thank you.
We'll move now to Dusan Simic. Your line is open.
Dusan? Good morning. I missed that slide 9, like onset GIOV, that inverted pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a good thing to have or not?
The inverted pyramid, and I guess I need to make this a little more clear. When you're using AIOVPs, you generally want to see the inverted pyramid, and that is good on the total operations. And, you know, you want to see the inverted pyramid go from a lot of ops down to a few. And if there's some AIOVPs down at the end that have zero, that's not going to hurt you. That just means you might have a few too many. If you see the inverted pyramid on the total ops being, you know, you have, you know, 500,000, 500,000, 400,000, 400,000, 400,000, and then it ends, you know, it really doesn't step down in orders of magnitude, you might not have enough AIOVPs. Is that what you were asking?
Yes, yes. How do I reduce or increase the number of IOVPs?
If you have the inverted pyramid and you have a lot of single-digit numbers at the very end,
yes,
then you can reduce them.
You can reduce them.
You can. But don't reduce them too aggressively.
All right.
Just do it slowly.
Slowly.
AIOVPs that are doing nothing take very little to no resources. If you reduce them, and you know, it's better to err on the side that's too much than too little. But if you have a lot of them, you can start taking them off. And you need to definitely monitor during checkpoints and during backup and restores, because those take a lot of I.O. and update statistics. Having too few when those are running can hurt you.
Thank you for this answer. And next one is, generally speaking, like what the best way to find out if we run out of resources, any resources. For example, I have a situation when IDS is in online state, but nobody cannot connect.
Well, one of the hardest resources to deal with is file descriptors.
Mm-hmm.
And we generally put a lot of out-of-resource messages into the online log, but if we're out of file descriptors, we can't open the log to write the message there. So I would definitely say monitor onstat-m for any error message, and the one to be very careful of is file descriptors. And there's a couple different kernel parameters for file descriptors. One is the total file descriptors across the entire computer system. People are generally okay with those, but you need to monitor it. The one that Informix users generally run into is the number of file descriptors per process, because we have to be able to open all the chunks and all the network users from a single process. And so Informix users generally run into the number of files per process limit.
But when you say number of file descriptor per process, is it number? But if I do U limit minus A, I get five file descriptors per user, not per process.
There's actually a kernel parameter, not a U-limit parameter, a kernel parameter that you have to set that allows the maximum number of file descriptors per process.
Oh, it's not U-limit that parameter.
It's not U-limit, no. U-limit can set a soft limit, but Informix, when running as root, can exceed that soft limit, so the U-limit doesn't even play a part. In a lot of operating systems, they used to set it fairly low. Now most people set it around 1,000. The OSs in general, can't say that for sure. But
I have 2,000, and I think it's okay. But you said Informix run as root can go over that soft limit.
Can go over the soft limit, not the hard limit. There's two limits you can set, a soft limit and a hard limit.
All right, I have to find out those two kernel parameters, what you mentioned, like file descriptor for system, for the old system, and number of file descriptors per process.
Yep. That's one of the big parameters that people generally run into.
And it's AIX. Is it at AIX automatically configured or must be manually?
I'm not positive on the newer OSs. On the old, I thought you had to manually do it. So I've not done 5.2 or 5.3, but I think in the 4s you had to manually do it.
But there's no name of it.
I always get mixed up between the operating systems, so I have to look. I deal with so many.
But you know name of those two kernel parameters?
No, I do not.
All right. Thank you very much. I think I took a lot of your time.
Not a problem. Love to help.
We'll go next to Alexi Sunken. Your line is open.
Hi, John. How are you today?
Super, Alexi. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you. I have a question about not default buffer sizes in Informix 10. How statistics about access to non-default pages, non-default size pages is represented in stat.p? That is it represented in terms of 2K pages, that is default platform default pages, or it's represented in terms of current pages, that is for DB spaces with increased page size?
Yeah, in version 10, when dealing with the multiple page size, I think the BUF option is a little bit more telling. But in the onstat-p, it is in the page size for the DB space.
Oh, for the DB space.
Yeah. So it's kind of told up. When you look at a buffer read, it's a buffer read for that page size. It's not normalized out, weighted in any way. So we will, look at that. But the onstat-g space BUF is an output that gives you all the different buffer reads and LRU information by page size. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah.
Yeah. So did that answer your question? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
My pleasure.
And our final question comes from Charles Connors. Your line is open.
I think this is off subject. I recently increased my AIO VP from 20 to 40 to throw more cleaners, to throw more AIO VPs at my buffers to clean them out faster to reduce my checkpoint duration.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually had the opposite effect. When I went from 20 to 40 AIO VPs, my checkpoint duration got longer. Any explanation for that?
How many, I know this is a little sometimes backwards, but how many disk drives do you have?
14.
14.
It's supposed to be RAID device, and I'm told there's 14 disk drives in there, but I have about 200 DB spaces. So the book says you base your AIO VPs on your chunks or your disk drives, so I decided to go with the chunks.
Yeah.
And it had an adverse effect.
My wording was a little slight but intentional. And when you look at the inverted pyramid and you look at the state and everything like that, it indicates an I/O problem, and adding AIOVPs can be one of the solutions. Mm-hmm. The other is you can't push any more I/O to the disk drive. You only can get so much throughput on each physical device. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, it really depends on how the disk drives act. Pushing more data than they can handle aggravates an existing problem. So if you have one disk drive that's running at 90% utilization, you might be able to add a little bit more to get up to the 98% utilization. But soon as you reach 100 or go to 105 or 110% utilization, you will notice that every time you add more workload, your current workload just keeps slowing down more and more. You don't even
exactly
get the throughput
happens.
You get at 90%. And so that's what you might have done.
Yeah.
And I'd actually have you look at like SAR or some I/O stat for your system to find out which, if it's just one of the, you know, devices or one of the RAIDs, and you can spread the data across, you might just solve your problem that way.
Yeah, I solved it by reducing the AIOVP back down to 20 and increasing my LRU max dirty parameter. I lowered it from 0.25 to 0.15. And now it's humming like a bird.
Great. I would still, have you look at the I/O on the different chunks, or specifically disks. If you find one that, is just a lot higher than the others.
I/O-wise?
Yeah.
Okay.
You might get a little more throughput out of it even yet.
If I take some of those tables out of that chunk and move it to a different one?
Yeah, or move the chunk from one device to another.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Gotcha. Thank you.
Great. Glad to hear things are working for you.
And we'll take our next question from Carl Ting.
Oh, for you. Hello.
Hello, Carl.
Hello, yes. Hi, I have a question on the CPU usage.
Mm-hmm.
When I run onset-glo, I get to display all my CPU. I basically got 7 CPU. And only 2 is really showing activity, and all the rest is really idle. Does that mean I'm not utilizing it correctly, or?
Yeah, that is, well, it means a few things that, and these are some blanket statements, and to really go into your specifics, we need a little more detail, but generally if you see 2, and this is total CPU seconds, not system and user, right?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that. Basically, I have a CPU in my machine, and I set up for 7 out of the 8 to be used in my system. And when I do the dash GGLO, I only see basically 2 of them that's really getting used.
When you say used, we break it out into 3 columns.
Correct.
One is user seconds, one is system seconds, and one is total seconds. And so when you're looking at them, I hope you're looking at the total seconds. And one thing that I do is onstat GGLO is broken into 2 sections, the top, which is a summary, and the bottom, which is by process.
Okay.
I take that top line that is a total, and it gives you a total seconds for your CPU VP class. It'll say, like, CPU VP. And in your case, it'll say you have 7 CPU VPs, and it'll say user, system, and total time. I take that total time, and then I do a sleep for, let's say, 300 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I run it again. Then I diff the 2 responses I got and divide it by 300. And that is the number of CPU VPs required to run your workload.
Okay. Can you repeat that one more time?
So I do an onstat GGLO.
Okay.
And get the, on the top, there's a CPU line that's on the totals.
Okay, right.
And there's a total of the time currently executed.
Correct, okay.
And then I do a sleep, looking over a long, a reasonably long measurement interval.
Okay.
So work goes on, and then I execute the command again.
Okay.
So I know that the two commands were separated by roughly 300 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I look at that total column again,
mm-hmm.
and I subtract the second one from the original. So that's a total number of CPU cycles required during that time.
Okay, gotcha.
And divide it by 300, which is the maximum each process could provide you.
Okay.
And, you know, if you come out with, like, 2.4,
mm-hmm.
well, that means, you know, you utilize 2.4 CPU VPs 100%. And, you know, most of the time you don't get 100% utilization.
Mm-hmm.
You should shoot for more like 90. And that tells you the number of CPU VPs required to really run your workload.
Okay, but does it hurt if I have these additional CPU?
They don't hurt anything. They're just going to sit there idle.
Okay, great. Because actually I have, like, multiple instances, to tell you the truth. I have, like, maybe close to 6 or 7 instances running on one machine.
Okay, then you want to tune your CPU VPs so each gets its own processor.
Okay, so you want me to do the affinity, assigning the CPU affinity?
You don't, a lot of operating systems do that. You can do the affinity,
uh-huh.
but I would not have each instance running with 6 or 7.
Okay.
And then you have 7 hardware processors. You know, I'd put each more down to 2.
Okay.
And then let them run, or 1.
Okay.
On the 1, there's actually, you have a single CPU setting, and you can avoid latching.
Okay, gotcha.
But it would take a little bit more into, you know, optimizing that. You have a few things going on, but it sounds like you might be over-resourced, and some of those might collide with the others.
Yeah, it does seem like that, because when I do VMstat out node to measure the CPU offside, it looks like it's getting hammered. But yet when I do the GLO,
each instance can't take 100% of the system.
Mm-hmm.
So the GLO is kind of assuming that it's going to get 7 hardware processors
mm-hmm.
utilized at 100%, and you're not giving it that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're better off. I mean, I'd almost right away go down to 2 for each system,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll probably operate. That's still 2. And you have 6, that's 12 hardware processors it kind of thinks it has.
Hmm.
So on some of the lower ones, I might even go down to 1.
Okay.
That's that single CPU, because that takes a lot of work out of the hardware.
Okay. So I guess the system is smart enough to know which CPU to use and all that, and somehow even out.
They are, and I wouldn't. If you affinity it wrong in your environment, you could really hurt yourself.
Okay.
So that's why I'd stay away from it initially.
Okay. Gotcha. Do I have time for one more question?
One quick one.
Okay. Well, it's actually the memory. I'm trying to find out how much memory the entire instance is used. I know the -G segment gives me the initial instance, memory instance, but when all the processors are running, how do I get all that?
On that -G seg does not give you initial. It gives you at the exact instance you run it.
Okay, gotcha.
Look at the last two columns, blocks used and free.
Mm-hmm.
And free is what, you know, tells you how much memory it's not using.
Okay, great. That's it.
Alrighty?
Yes. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. That would conclude our question and answer session. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference back to our speakers for any additional or closing comments.
I want to thank everyone today who attended. We really appreciate you being with us, and we enjoy trying to share information and knowledge with all of you. I know this takes some time and some effort on your part, so we really appreciate it. I also would like to thank Linda for putting this on. She does a great job of keeping this going, and I think it just helps our community. And also like to thank Stuart, you know, a strong advocate in making sure the IUG, the Informix product, and the Informix community keep working for you and the entire DBA and user community. So a big thanks to those people. And, again, thank you for your time and effort on this. And we'll keep these going. And let us know what you like and what you don't like, and we'll try and accommodate you. Again, thank you all, and have a great day.
Thank you so much for your participation, everyone, in today's conference. You may disconnect at this time. Thank you.
Hello?
Hello?
Great job.